Welcome to this month's episode of Pull Up a Chair, an original podcast series produced by CFA Society Boston. I'm Board Chair Sarah Samuels, and I'm here today with Lily Lyman, leader in the venture capital industry, entrepreneur, and global businesswoman. Lily talks about the lessons she learned during her time working internationally to spread the entrepreneurial spirit, leading international expansion at Facebook, and leading a venture firm, all while embracing her belief in regularly operating outside one's comfort zone. Welcome to the podcast, Lily.
Yes, thank you.
Lily, this podcast is about bravery in the investment industry and beyond, and we can all learn a lot from you about bravery, particularly in the way that you challenge yourself to get outside of your comfort zone. You've lived and worked in 75 countries, you founded your own startup, and you led the expansion of Facebook internationally. And today you run a venture firm. So all of those things take some bravery, and we're going to hear a lot more about all of those. But to kick off our discussion today, can you tell us about a foundational childhood experience that formed who you are today?
Thank you again for having me and for doing this incredible work and sharing these stories. I've been listening to all the episodes, and it's just, they're very inspiring. So I feel honored to be here. So start with that. A foundational story in my childhood, I think there's two that come to mind that I think have shaped who I am and how I am and how I view the world. One of them is I come from a big family. I'm one of four. I'm number two out of four. I'm the middle child, which I think I'm a big believer in birth order personality traits. But the other element was that my parents both have big groups of friends and are very welcoming and open. And we always had people living in our home. I have a friend of a friend who needed a place to stay or somebody passing through town. We lived in New York City. And to me, it was an important dynamic in terms of always welcoming people and the value of having community. I felt like I had a community in my own home all the time and always felt like I was part of a tribe. And as I was reflecting on this question, the fact that I'm at a community-driven venture firm sort of ties to that. I think I'm a believer in surrounding yourself in wonderful people and being open to getting to know them no matter what walk of life or what they're interested in and things like that. So that is one I'd call out. The other I'd call out is I actually was a very serious gymnast growing up. My childhood dream was to be in the Olympics. I trained with a Romanian coach starting in about third grade. And I think it was important foundation for me around dedication and discipline and also juggling. I literally used to wear my leotard under my clothes at school so I could run off to gymnastics practice for another 4 hours after school at a very young age. But it was passion. I loved it. So it was a passion-driven work ethic that I think has carried me through my life and my career.
And you considered going all the way to the Olympics and work with Bella Caroli, but you decided not to, and you decided to take the traditional educational route. Can you tell us about your education?
Yes, and I'm grateful I did that. And I'm grateful my parents helped me make that decision. So I was very lucky and fortunate in my education, something that my family really prioritized. And I grew up in New York City and went to an all-girls school there. And I think that formed a lot of my desire and consciousness around how to empower women and why that matters. And also a foundational belief that there's nothing we can't do and why couldn't you do it? And I think that some of that perspective and strength came from those 10 years that I spent in an all-girls environment. I think it helped build confidence as I went off to high school. It was a place where it was okay to be nerdy, which is great because I was super nerdy. And it was okay to be into academics. So that was an important experience. Then I went away for high school. I actually went off to a boarding school, and part of it was this concept that my dad had instilled in me, which is the importance of getting out of your comfort zone. And he literally drew a little bullseye for me back when I must have been 12 or 13. And he said, this is inside your comfort zone and this is outside your comfort zone. And he just encouraged me that whenever I had the opportunity to get outside my comfort zone, to go do that. And good things would come. You would learn, you would grow, you would stretch, you would discover. That changed my education path for high school. And then it's formed some of the decisions I've made later in life. And then I went off to Harvard for college. I actually took a gap year in between the two, which is a little bit unusual. It was unusual at the time. Again, it was part of the get out your comfort zone. I wanted to travel and explore the world and see what else was out there. So I worked at a school in New Zealand. I worked in DC in politics for a while. I traveled around Europe, and then I worked in the Athens Olympics. It was an amazing year. Every experience stretched me outside my comfort zone, got me out of the structure that I had grown up with. And I think it helped me get more out of my college experience because I appreciated it. I recognized the value of being in a learning environment. And I also had a little more insight into where and how I might apply it later in life. So I'm really grateful I did that. And I think it's changed how I approached the steps that came after.
getting out of your comfort zone very well aligns with what we're talking about with bravery, and that if you are brave, you really can't be brave unless you're scared, right? You can't get out of your comfort zone unless you're uncomfortable, and that your belief that this will always lead to something positive, I think is really inspirational for anyone listening to this podcast. Just try something scary and see what happens. So when you talked about your education at Harvard, you describe a transformational experience in terms of your area of study. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So I studied a concentration at Harvard called social studies, which sounds like a sixth grade class. And I often get asked, do you know all the capitals and things like that? But it's actually an interdisciplinary honors major at Harvard where you study a little bit of a bunch of things. So you study economics, statistics, religion, philosophy, social theory, government, a variety of things. And you start with this very intensive social theory course in your sophomore year, where you study all the great social theorists, Durkheim and Adam Smith and Marx and Freud and Weber and a whole bunch of other folks. And it's very intensive. And so it's an academic experience that's probably one of the most intense I've ever had. But it also sets a groundwork for really critical thinking, going back to the basics. People talk a lot in business about first principles. It grounds you in that. And then you use that as a lens to understand all different types of problems and how civilizations and societies have evolved along the way. And so it shaped a lot of how I think. I think it was one of the hardest I've ever worked. And it also helped set me on my path where I ultimately wanted to take that and explore different problems around international development, growth of different societies and economies. And that's what ultimately led me to my first job out of college, which actually really changed my career trajectory. I applied to this fellowship program at Princeton called Princeton Latin America. I got placed with an amazing organization called Endeavor, which works with entrepreneurs in emerging markets and basically tries to identify the most promising entrepreneurs and companies and then connect them with advisors and resources and talent and ultimately capital as well. And it's just an incredible organization. And it is why I am where I am today, because I think it opened my eyes to the power of entrepreneurship and the power of technology to change the world and to transform economies, to transform technologies and entire industries. And you know, prior to that, I actually thought I wanted to go into the School of Foreign Service. I wanted to go into foreign policy. My long-term dream was to be Secretary of State. And the Endeavor experience really, it changed my view on that. It was also an experience where I had an opportunity to go outside my comfort zone. So I was assigned to go to Santiago, Chile with the Endeavor office there. And they, at the time, were opening a brand new office in Northern Patagonia. And I just arrived. My Spanish wasn't awesome. Not that profound. And the head of the office said, hey, do you want to go move to Northern Patagonia and open up a new office? I knew nothing about the place, didn't know anything about the people. But again, it was an opportunity to get outside my comfort zone. So I took a 13-hour bus south to Northern Patagonia and arrived in this small little town on a lake next to a volcano. I was one of the only Americans there. And I loved it and just threw myself into the fire and figured it out. And I ended up staying for an extra year beyond my fellowship because I just had such an incredible experience.
So you learned a lot about entrepreneurship. You learned a lot about business in different countries, and you decided to take a consulting job. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So my takeaway from the Endeavor experience, I spent a lot of time looking and working with different types of founders. I worked with everything from shipbuilders to technologies that were servicing the salmon industry to other higher tech opportunities to tech and agriculture, so a variety of different founders. And then I also got exposed to these incredible mentors who were often venture capitalists or very experienced business people who could help advise these companies. And I saw the power of transforming the company building process. And so my takeaway was, oh, wow, I either want to go be one of those founders or go be one of those smart business people, advisors and investors who can help founders and empower and enable them. So my first thought was like, oh, I got to go learn more about business in order to do that. So let me go into consulting because it feels like a fast way to learn a lot of those skills. And actually, I think in many ways that's true. You learn a lot. So I spent 2 years at this wonderful firm called Dahlberg, which does a lot of international work and impact work as well. And I met some incredible people. I learned a lot about professionalism and different business and entering new markets and things like that. But it felt far away from the entrepreneurial world and getting your hands dirty. You often build a deck and then leave it and you don't know if anybody uses it or not. I applied to business school and was lucky enough to get into my dream school at the time, which was Stanford, because I wanted to be in the heart of Silicon Valley, the heart of innovation and tech. So went out there and then I spent all my time at Stanford focused on the entrepreneurship classes, the venture classes. I just couldn't get enough of it. And while I was at Stanford, I was testing a couple hypotheses. I'm a believer. If you go to grad school or business school, it's a great opportunity to test hypotheses about what you might want to do. And one of mine was on the entrepreneurship path. One of them was the operating path. And then one of them was the investing path. So I used that time to test those three hypotheses. And I ended up through a class at the design school falling into an opportunity to found a company in the ag tech space. We had built a product and stumbled upon an interesting opportunity. We had a great team. We did all the pitch competitions on campus and raised a little bit of money that way. And ultimately, I did it for a while after school. It was a company in the coffee space. And it was a great learning experience. I've learned that 0-to-1 founder journey and how hard it can be. And at the end of the day, ultimately, I didn't have founder market fit, which I think is something that not everybody talks about that much. But particularly, we work with a lot of founders on campuses here in Boston, and we'll probably talk about that. But anyway, it was a great experience, but ultimately wasn't the right long-term fit for me. I moved on and then ultimately found myself at Facebook at an opportunity to help. Our mandate was to get the next 1 billion people onto the platform. And a lot of the barrier we're trying to solve was access to the internet. So how do we get people, largely in emerging markets, access to the internet so that then they could become users on the Facebook products across Facebook, WhatsApp, Messenger, and Instagram.
Can you tell us some more about what you mean by founder market fit and what it makes me think of if it's not a good fit, if you're going to fail forward? So maybe tell us a little bit about that and maybe expand it. Is there a way to apply founder market fit to the average person who's working in the company?
That's a good question. So what I mean in my case, founder market fit, honestly, it's actually one of the things I look for most as an investor now, because what I inherently mean by it is there a reason why this founder has a unique reason why they'll be great at building this company and have an unfair advantage? So is there something about their background or something about what they've learned or the way that they're approaching the problem that they're going after that makes them uniquely positioned for it? And are they obsessed with the problem? One of the questions I always ask founders is, if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing? If you weren't starting this company, what else would you be doing? And some of the most compelling answers are, I would find another way to solve the problem I'm going after. And maybe it's through big company or some other approach, but this problem is so important to me. And I feel so strongly that I would find another way to do it. So I did not have that in my business. It was a consumer company and I am a software person and we were building CPG products. And so I didn't have the love of the space and the obsession with the problem to get me through the grit that is required for that 0-to-1 phase. In terms of applying it to somebody who maybe is in a different role or different industry, I think understanding your own motivations. And some people are motivated by business problems alone, and they maybe don't care the specific topics, or they're motivated by building, but can build in a variety of different industries. And that works for some people. I learned for myself that doesn't work. I have to believe and be obsessed with what it is I'm trying to build. And so I think that could apply to founder market fit or employee market fit, if you will. What are your motivations and what matters to you most? And those can also change over time. What is it that you're trying to learn or achieve in this chapter? I always like to think of careers in chapters, and you can optimize for different things in different moments of your career, which I think is helpful because it makes it less daunting in terms of, are you in the right spot? And maybe you're in the right spot for right now, and that can work. And then maybe think about, okay, in my next chapter, I might prioritize something else. And so I think it helps make it more approachable if you break it down into smaller chapters.
Such a great point. And we've talked on this podcast before about nonlinear careers, and it all comes together if you let the process do its job. So we went over your Facebook experience very briefly, but you were there at an interesting time. Tell us a little more about what it took to get the business scaled in the way that you were tasked with doing internationally.
It was a really exciting time to be there because Facebook was still very focused on growth at the time, but growth was ultimately going to be capped by how many people had access to the internet. So that was our mandate, which was, how do we work across a variety of different approaches in order to get more people access? And there are three buckets to it. One was an infrastructure bucket. One was a cost of data plans bucket. So data is still very expensive in many parts of the world to have a data plan on your cell phone. And then the third part was an education component. So what is the internet? How do I use it? What's the benefit of it? Why should I sign up for a data plan? And so that's what ultimately our broader team was tasked with. And at the time when we first started, it felt like a startup within Facebook, which was fun. We were adjusting the Facebook products for low connectivity environments. We were forming these really complicated partnerships with mobile operators and telecoms, which felt like, I didn't have the language at the time, but it basically was like a big enterprise go-to-market sale process. An account management process. It was an exciting, extremely challenging project and mandate. And our team was very international. We spent a lot of time on planes, like flying all over the world to parts of the world I never thought I'd spend multiple trips in, Namibia and Senegal and Indonesia and Philippines and Bolivia. I learned so much in that environment from how do you build product and test it and ship it and know if it's working and then ultimately scale it. We ended up having 100 million new users come on in 3 years through our product specifically. So that experience was incredible. I'm working with world-class data science, engineering, and product teams, which Facebook has, but also building and managing an international organization with people from all different backgrounds and all different cultures and all different views, and how do you make that whole organization work? So it was an invaluable learning experience. It was very exciting. It was very challenging. It was very complex. And I take a lot of those learnings into how I think about business building alongside of our companies, how I think about building Underscore, even though we're much smaller and more focused, more lean, and also just the humility of what it takes to build worldwide products. Like, it's really hard. And I think that humility is important.
So you went from being an operator to an investor and making investments in companies. So you had time as an entrepreneur when you were at Stanford, then you worked as an operator within a more established organization, but an entrepreneurial type of mandate, and shifted gears to go to the investment side. A bit of a controversial question is, do you think that you could have been a great investor without the operational experience?
I love this question because we get asked it a lot. And I think particularly a lot of aspiring investors say, oh, do I need to go operate first? And my honest answer is, I think there's so many different ways to be a great investor. And different experiences can be different assets in different ways. So some people come from the operating track into investing the way I did. Some people come from a finance track. Some people come from a totally different track. I think one of the best investors I know is Rebecca Keaton, who was a journalist before business school and then went into investors. And now she's one of the stars at USB. So I don't think there's any one way. And I like to share that because I don't think anyone should be discouraged from investing if they feel like based on their background. I actually often have a lot of people saying, I haven't done finance. That's for early stage investing. That's okay. You can figure it out. There's the finance piece you can learn. For this stage of investing, I think growth is a little bit different. But for me, it was definitely helpful because I think it helps me, as I said, have empathy and humility for founders and builders in terms of what does it actually take to build some of these things and get them out into the world and then build a go-to-market machine around it. So I think that was very useful. There's certain parts of the operating side around product management, around go-to-market that I definitely apply and try to help advise our companies on. And so it also gave me a perspective on what great looks like and certain talent and certain types of builders. So for me, it was very useful. I think also for investors, you have to have a reason why founders will choose you. And I think having that both empathy and concrete operating experience, I think a lot of founders value that, particularly at the earliest stages, because where we invest at pre-seed and seed, that is a lot of it is building your initial team, getting your first product out there, figuring out what does product market fit look like for this company specifically. And so I think having done pieces of that before, obviously in a larger environment, but I think that can be helpful because it's very tangible.
So to begin your transition from operator to investor, you started with angel investing. Tell us about that transition.
Yeah, I think starting around my time at Stanford, maybe a little bit before actually, after Underscore, I was excited and inspired by founders at the earliest stages. And so started angel investing tiny amounts at the time, but it was just to get in the flow and to learn and understand what does it mean to be a part of this early stage company building and investing side. And then I got invited by Yard Ventures, which is Harvard's angel alumni group, to be a part of their group and to join their investment committee. And that's where I got more reps around meeting founders, looking at decks, taking pitches and things like that. And transparently just fell in love with it. And I always had this itch of maybe I should be doing this all the time. And I always say that my time at Facebook sometimes always felt like an itchy sweater. There's a lot that I loved and was great about it, but I think there's pieces that I knew in my heart wasn't quite the right fit. So that's how I started doing more and more angel investing. And I think that's part of what helped me make that jump from operating over to venture.
Okay. So now you're an investor, you're leading a venture capital firm, and you're making important investments in the Boston ecosystem and beyond. One of the really interesting things about you is that we have 6,000 plus listeners in the Boston community and many more beyond, but you have a big tie to the entrepreneurial spirit in Boston. And we would love to hear about that as well as how you do what you do.
Yes, part of the founding story of Underscore was that there's a real opportunity for early stage investing in Boston. And at the time when we were founded back in 2015, 2016, it was underbanked, if you will. A lot of the big established firms had turned their attention out west, and there weren't as many folks doing early stage investing, pre-seed and seed. But there's still this incredible, robust ecosystem here. And there's three pieces of the environment here that I get very excited about. One of them is the consistent flow of talent that is coming through Boston because of the universities here. Every year, there's 250,000 students in this city. That's extraordinary. And COVID or not COVID, people came here. So I think Boston in particular has a geographic importance that being physically on the ground here will always be relevant. And that talent combined with the technology and the research that's being developed, and again, these university ecosystem is extraordinary. It's unparalleled. There's more STEM degrees issued here than anywhere else in the world. So that's one bucket that we get very excited about. I think increasingly we get excited about the incredible talent that is spinning out of some of the homegrown success cases here. So companies like HubSpot and Salsify and Acquia and Flywire and Toast and Wayfair, there's some really interesting software, particularly B2B software companies where we invest that have reached scale and people have done that zero to 100 million in revenue, beyond billion revenue in some cases. And some of those folks are spinning off and starting new things. And so we're seeing a lot of that, those mafias, if you will. And so that's an area that we get excited about. And then the third piece is a lot of the big tech companies actually have pretty strong arms here. Facebook, Amazon, Google, all have teams on the ground. And so there's a really rich dynamic of talent. And again, talent plus tech. So I think we want to be a part of finding those opportunities early and seeding them. And if they stay here, great. If not, that's also fine. We want to capture them as they come through here. And so over half our capital is here. We do invest other places, but I think there's a lot to be excited about Boston. And I think it often gets underestimated or people assume that it's just healthcare. But Carta actually did some good research this year. And Boston was actually number two ecosystem for seed and Series A funding. And yes, healthcare and biotech are a big piece of that. Although in healthcare, there's so many interesting software and data opportunities in healthcare. And that's a lot where we invest. But also areas like B2B software, areas like vertical SaaS. So things like supply chain, logistics, manufacturing, insurance is where I spend a fair amount of time. Commerce enablement, fintech even. And actually increasingly, we're seeing a ton in climate in this area as well. So there's a lot beyond just biotech here in Boston that I think people often underestimate.
How do you collaborate with the universities and colleges?
It's a huge part of what we do. It's a big part of our thesis. Every year, we'll invest in sort of one or three companies coming out of Harvard, MIT, Babson, Northeastern, Tufts, BU. There's some great companies coming out of this ecosystem. And actually, if you look at the numbers, there are more founders and companies getting funded who have raised more venture dollars at the graduate school level, at least coming out of Harvard and MIT than Stanford and Berkeley. So it's a really robust opportunity set from an investing perspective. So we both formally and informally partner with all the universities in town. From a formal perspective, we've partnered with the on-campus funds at places like Harvard and MIT. So the Alston Fund and the MIT Sandbox Fund. We've also partnered with Dorm Room Fund, which is an incredible student sort of scout investing model. And so we partner with them to help identify some of the most promising companies. We also spend a lot of time walking the halls. I think the reality of being able to canvas and cover these opportunity sets is you got to be on the ground. So we do workshops, we do mentorship, we do office hours, we do judging and pitch competition support and things like that. So we spend a good amount of our time literally walking the halls on these various campuses. And it's both inspiring to see what young, smart people are thinking about and what problems do they want to solve. And from an investing perspective, we think you can build a very strong portfolio that can return a lot of capital to our LPs, who we're also grateful to have a lot of the great institutions and endowments in the Boston area as part of our LP base.
And how would you compare and contrast the Harvard versus the MIT entrepreneurs?
Yes, I was getting nervous doing this because I don't like to stereotype people, but I think from an MIT perspective, we certainly see a lot of technological or product and solution-oriented founders. They've unlocked something from a technology perspective that is very powerful. And then they need to often figure out which problem are they targeting it at or which one is it most suited to. Oftentimes it can do a lot of different things, but figuring out, okay, we have this unique technology, then where do we apply it? And then how do we build a business around it? And so that's an area that, you know, particularly in AI, we're seeing some of the most powerful research is coming out of that institution. On the Harvard side, we spend a lot of time more at the graduate schools. We spend some time with the undergrads as well, but the business school, the engineering school, we see interesting things coming out of the medical school as well. I think it's a variety, I'd say, from the business school side. The founders we get very excited coming out of that environment are those who have been in industry for a while and have experienced a certain pain point based on their previous experience, have gone to business school to perhaps make that jump over to the entrepreneurial journey. There's an incredible program called the MSMBA program at Harvard that I think has a particularly unique DNA of founders. But some of the investments we've made coming out of there are folks who have, they were either in insurance for many years before or in MarTech or in pharma. And so they've lived the problem and then now are using their grad school experience to help catalyze the start of a business.
Excellent. All right, shifting gears now to your organization, to your GP. You've gone through or are going through a generational transition. Can you tell us what that's been like?
Yeah, it's been an interesting experience where, from what I've heard, this is where a lot of venture firms stumble and have a footfall. And I just have incredible respect and appreciation for the founders of our firm, Michael and John, who built Underscore to be multi-generational from day one. They knew that they wanted this to be an enduring franchise, and they set it up that way from literally from the first moment. That was part of the long-term vision, which was how do we back the next generation of iconic companies and how do we build the next generation of great investors in Boston? And interestingly, that's part of what I got so excited about when I joined. When I joined, they were very explicit. They said, if this all works out, you guys will be running this firm. And so we have been building towards that over the last couple of years, everything from a very deliberate apprenticeship model around joining board meetings, joining CEO one-on-one calls, getting involved in portfolio construction and management, meeting LPs and building those relationships. We've had this deliberate process over the last, honestly, it's been 6 years, but particularly the last couple of years. And so in the past year, we formalized this transition to myself and my partners, Chris Gerner, Rich DeLude, and Jameer Sillo as the GPs running the business. And we've been grateful to have great LPs who have bought into this vision from the beginning and have supported us as we've made this transition as well. But it's funny, I think I take it for granted. It's actually been like relatively straightforward for us. But as I talk to more and more people in the industry, I realize how rare that is.
It is a very common area. So you lead some areas at Underscore in your investing day job. You also lead the organization. But in your investment work, you lead the future of work, digital transformation, alternative intelligence, machine learning. Can you tell us some of your views on the areas that you lead?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most exciting times to be an investor, particularly an early stage investor. I think there's later stages that have opportunity, but also challenges. But early stage, we're seeing so much opportunity with founders who deeply know their space and their domain. As I said, this is one of the things that's most important to us, which is why this founder. And then this is tectonic shift, obviously, with the launch and the rapid adoption of AI. And then there's also still a ton of industries and spaces that have not been fully digitized yet, as I think about digital transformation. So we're still early in that journey for a lot of industries. And so that's where I personally spend a lot of my time, areas like insurance, which has so much potential as you think about it from a data perspective and where AI and machine learning can be applied. But there's still a lot that needs to be figured out. And so things like how are we digitizing and capturing some of that data and then using it from a internal proprietary vertical data set perspective and what models can you build there? Then there's also tooling that is needed for that. So things like security and what is the AI workbench? We're seeing a lot of opportunities there. So that's where we spend a fair amount of our time. With teammates who spend time in supply chain logistics, manufacturing. My partner Chris spends a lot of time in fintech. And then Rich spends a lot of time in emerging infrastructure. So I think that the combination of this wave from a technology disruption perspective, it also creates challenges. There's a lot of hype. There's a lot of noise. 90% of the decks we saw in the last 6 months had AI in them. And you have to really parse through, where is the real value going to be created? Do you need to have AI applied here? Is it defensible? Or is there a use case of it that's going to give it a real advantage? And coming back to your original question, I think the areas that we spend a lot of time in is what are these specific verticalized opportunities where data is being created that it hasn't been before because of digitization? And then how is that data being used in order to create an unfair advantage? And also changing the way work gets done, which I think it really is. I know a lot of people are scared about it from a future work perspective. I think that if we do this right, it's an opportunity to automate away the things that humans are not uniquely capable of and lean into what we are uniquely capable of. And so I think if we get that, what's going to change the way that software gets built, it's going to change the way that software gets delivered, it's going to change the way that we all use it day to day, but it can be in a way that's very empowering. Those are high level thoughts of what we get excited about.
All right. So we're going to close with two questions. The first is, do you have a call to action for our listeners?
I do, and I'm going to cheat and do two. One is just embracing the power of community. I really believe it in my bones that surrounding yourself with wonderful people, it changes your life and it makes your life a lot more fun. And so people who believe in you, who open doors for you, who support you, and then who work alongside of you. It just really, people is everything. And I just don't think that there's a substitute. And it takes time to invest in those relationships. But my belief is that it's completely worth it and will pay off in the end. And then my second piece of advice is this concept that my college lacrosse coach always said, which is this idea of find a way. She was referring to digging deep at the end of the game when you're really tired and you need to sprint down the field, find a way, dig deep. But I feel this mantra, it's always been a part of my personal philosophy that you can find a way to do almost anything. Like you can do it. And this past year, I think it was very hard in the industry in general. I think it was a difficult year from a macroeconomic perspective, from a banking crisis perspective, from a fundraising perspective for founders and also for VCs. And so our team talked about it a lot is you got to dig deep and find your grit and find a way. And I think with that mentality, whether it's, I don't know, blind confidence or not, I think it helps you navigate the challenges that are inevitably going to be thrown your way.
Those are great calls to action. All right. Last question is a bit of a personal one. If you're comfortable sharing a moment of bravery.
I like this question. I think it's great that you ask it. So I had an experience in 2017 when I basically had a lot of life changes happening all at the same time. I was moving from San Francisco back to Boston. I had decided to leave Facebook and join Underscore. So I was changing not just jobs, but also industries. And I was also expecting my first child. All of those things happened all at the same time. I was about 6 months pregnant when I joined Underscore back at the end of 2017. And a lot of people thought I was crazy. They said, look, why don't you stay at Facebook? Weird job. You're good at it. They have great maternity leave. Like, why are you changing all these things all at the same time? But I was just so compelled by the opportunity to join Underscore. And I was such a believer in the team and the values and the community approach that I didn't want to pass up that opportunity. And so I jumped in. And I think that was a moment where I was brave in terms of embarking on a whole bunch of unknown things all at the same time. People ask me all the time, I have 3 kids under the age of 5 and I run a venture firm. They're like, how do you do it? And I don't have anything brilliant except for you find a way. You put one foot in front of the other. You figure it out. You have some self-grace along the way because you're probably not going to get everything right all the time. But that moment of bravery is one that I actually do like to share because I often get asked, when's the right time to start a family? When's the right time to do that? There's no right time. As you want an example, I was a perfect example. That was not the right time. But that's what life throws you. And it's okay to take on the hard stuff, find a way, be a little bit brave, get out of your comfort zone, and put one foot in front of the other.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Lily.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to everyone for listening to this episode of Pull Up a Chair. Join us each month as we continue our conversation with fascinating industry leaders. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. For more information on CFA Society Boston, visit us online at cfaboston.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.